Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities that are at the heart of what we believe is this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine, and Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Oh, excellent. Doing great, and glad to have a good lineup for tonight.
Very excited about the program that we're doing this evening. We've also got our chat host, Michael Darling, with us.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Michael. Building up the momentum in the chat room, I guess there was a little bit of confusion as to what time we're starting this evening, so hopefully folks are stopping by the site, figuring out that we're on now, and getting the program going. This is, in fact, our fourth program in our special all-summer-long series, The World Transformed. We've had three great shows leading up to this one, and tonight is going to be no exception. We've got a terrific lineup of guests, and our topic is reworking the human architecture. We're going to be talking about enhancements, modifications, augmentations to human beings. And let's bring out our panel, Stephen, and get this thing going. What do you say?
That sounds good.
All right.
We've got an old friend with us tonight that's actually subbing.
Yeah, well, we do, but you know what? I have to save her for last because she gets a special intro that I was. I have to build up to that one. It's,
All right.
We should start with the new people. So, for the first time ever, we're very pleased to welcome Are You Serious to Fast Forward Radio. Are You is the man who shows us where cyber culture and counterculture meet. He is a writer, a talk show host, a musician, and he's the editor of H Plus Magazine. Are You Serious? Welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you so much. Yes, great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and we're looking forward to speaking with you this evening. And yet we do, in fact, have two old friends returning. Stephen, why don't you introduce the first of those?
Well, we got PJ Manny coming back to us this evening. PJ, you got started. Well, you were a transhumanist before you knew what transhumanism was, weren't you?
Yeah, I guess so. And it's a word that I'm not terribly fond of, so sure, why not?
She started writing a book in 2005, and the subject was transhumanism, and I think she prefers the term H+ to describe
what.
Okay.
That is kind of the preferred, the politically correct term these days. Well, actually, I meant for you to welcome our other guest there, Stephen, because I had saved this special intro for PJ, but I'll come back to that. And we're also pleased to welcome another longtime friend of this program, Brian Wong, who is a futurist who blogs about all things future related at Next Big Future. He is the director of research for the Lifeboat Foundation, and he's a member of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology Task Force. Brian, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, we're delighted to have you and looking forward to talking with you. Now, Stephen, you actually did a substantive intro of PJ. My intro was going to be, PJ Manny is a writer and futurist who was once chased by pirates in the South China Sea.
You know, that's actually the best intro I've ever had. Thank you.
Well, there you go. Actually, I was reading through your bio, and I was like, well, that's uber cool. We got to throw that out there. And let me just make this a little more personal. This is really interesting. You know, my wife is Malaysian, and among the different ethnic Malaysian groups that she is descended from, one of them is called the Orang Laut. These are the people of the sea, and they are actually, some would call, pirates in the South China Sea. So it's entirely possible that I'm related to the people who were chasing you that time.
I won't take it personally.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just business, right? It's not personal. So we're really glad to have you with us, PJ. PJ stepping in at the last minute for George Dvorsky, who's not able to be with us, was looking forward to talking with us this evening on this topic, and something came up. So George, we miss you. All the best to you, and we'll catch up with you somewhere down the road, I'm sure, talking about these subjects. So that's our panel, and before we get into our topic of the evening, which is reworking the human architecture, what I thought I would do, folks, is start off with our two big questions about transformation that we've been asking all of our guests throughout this series, and we'll continue to do through the remainder of the series. So we'll start with you, Aryu. The two questions are, first, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime? And secondly, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime if it's different from the first thing?
The greatest transformation, I would have to say it's the Internet at this point. I think that's almost obvious. It's changed everything about how we live, changed everything about our economy. It's just quickened the pace of exchange and experimentation and sharing of information to such a high degree. I don't think you can really compare anything to it. It's changing the political dynamics all over the world as well. So it's the obvious one, but that's the one I think that's got to be it. I'm hoping that there will be a neurological change within my lifetime, that human beings will be able to have really precise drugs and other mechanisms for controlling their brain states, that we can eliminate the worst types of psychological diseases and problems, that we can access the information that we do have in our brains, that we can access our memories, that we can be operating at the highest levels of intelligence that our brains are capable of, that we can also access pleasurable states and so forth with relative ease. I think that's something that I really hope occurs during the next decade, and if not then during the decade after that.
That will certainly be an astounding transformation were we once we see that happen, let's put it that way, not were we to, because I think we almost certainly will, but it's more a question, as I think as you implied there, of when. Okay, great. Brian, same questions to you.
Well, I'd go probably a little broader than, and then just probably go with information technology and computers in general. In terms of, like, witnessing myself, I actually saw, like, operating card reading computers back when I was just, 5 or 6 years old. Even an older age, it was still being used. Actually, just the year before I took my first year of computer science in high school, my brother, was the grade ahead of me, was using the University of Regina's card reading computer. So he wrote computer programs on that. He got retired just before I got there, but he'd actually have the deck of cards and stick in his line written program. I got to use an advanced PET computer, so got to use those. Ironically, the year before that, actually, because I was in grade 9 when that happened. Grade 10 actually. But in the previous year, in grade 9, I was in the States because my father was a math professor, and we'd go to the States, and we were in Delaware. I won a computer contest there, and I got to use a supercomputer at the University of Delaware. So it's kind of the whole mismatch of the fact that University of Regina had crap and University of Delaware had really good stuff. So it was like playing these touch-sensitive computer ant wars in Delaware and then going back and using garbage in there. But things have caught up, and you know, I have fantastic computers now. So
amazing, those two worlds kind of coexisting at the same time. To
yeah.
step out of one of those and into the other is had to be quite a shock.
Yep, it was.
So looking ahead,
sorry,
Stephen, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, Brian, how does that supercomputer compare from back then compared to, well,
computers now?
Like the computer? Yeah, computers now, maybe even the computer on your desk.
Yeah, so it was a Plato supercomputer. I think it was one of those CDC, I think the, I don't remember the name of it. I think it started with a C, CDC. It was like a pre-Cray. So I think it had maybe... I'm thinking 50 megaflops, maybe. It was you know, pretty good for its time.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it was many years before I worked at a computer as good as that. But, of course, now, like, you know, my iPhone or whatever is probably better than what that was.
Than that supercomputer. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So looking ahead, what do you anticipate to be the greatest transformation you'll see in your lifetime?
Well, looking ahead, I'm looking for a longer lifetime. So I'm expecting... SENS and other things like it to work out, and we already have some new pills that can extend the life, you know, a pill that can extend the life of mice, except it has the problem of suppressing the immune system. So it's already FDA-approved for humans, but it suppresses the immune system. So it's a matter of fixing that so it doesn't cause, you know, something that does the same thing but doesn't cause those side effects, and then to get it more powerful with SENS and all that other stuff, or maybe nanomedicine, to really get some enhancement going, but we'll be talking more about that kind of stuff going forward.
That is our topic this evening. Okay, so
absolutely, longer life. That's a big one. PJ, looking backward, what's the biggest thing, biggest transformation in your lifetime so far?
Well, not surprisingly, Are You Serious has paved the way for part of my answer, as he always does. I'd put my own spin on it, though. Beyond internet or IT, I would actually make it larger and call it all media. I'm so stunned by the fact that as a child, I lived in a world where media was something that was served to you, complete, by someone who was selling it to you because they were the only people capable of making it. Now, because of computers, because of the internet, because of IT, everyone is capable of creation and sharing it instantly all over the world. And that kind of communication is so extraordinary, that change in paradigm of what it meant for people like us as young people versus people like my children who know no other world than being able to talk to someone on the other side of the planet, not just instantly, but share media instantly. That is, if anything makes our world smaller, it's going to be that. And looking forward, let me spin off from that idea, and that is that what that means is media is not something you pick up or you read or you watch. We are the media. What we create is something that we can instantly put out there. And the fact that we are the media is going to continue as one of the things that I both hope for and see happening much more quickly than I think most people realize is this neurosociety, as Zach Lynch calls it. And the melding of that neurosociety with our malleable media is... That I think is going to have an enormous effect on what we perceive the world to be.
And
absolutely.
Would you relate that to the notion of one of the terms that keeps coming up when we have these discussions is the idea of the prosumer? Is that the kind of the kind of idea you're talking about?
Well, in some cases it's the prosumer, but in other cases, it's simply a desire to connect. It's not so much producing a product, per se, as simply creating something as a form of self-expression representing yourself. All you have to do is go onto YouTube and see countless hours of people's idea of self-expression. And
right.
granted, 99% of it, honestly, may not be worth watching to one person or another. But to someone, it means something, be it just the producer or their friends or people the subject matter matters to, et cetera. So in a funny way, because we are all media, that fragmentation we've already been experiencing of media where, you know, we went from, let's say in the United States, we had 3 television channels and now we have 500 television channels. Or, you know, that will continue, I believe, logarithmically as it has already, which will have so many countless things to consume, media to consume. We're going to have to figure out how do we deal with all this information.
I think, I mean, with young people particularly, I don't think they think of themselves as prosumers. They're just living in the environment.
Right.
They're
yeah,
just living
I,
in
I
the
agree.
Environment of media. They're social networking and, you know, continuous partial attention and, you know, this is just the world in which we live. I'm always impressed by how quickly human beings, and particularly young human beings in the society, take things into themselves. In the future, that will be literally, but now they're just taking things close to themselves, you know, these prostheses and so forth, and just adapt to them totally and make their own cultures out of it.
Amazing stuff. Yeah, you think of maybe one of the keys to being a true prosumer is you don't think you're one. It would never occur to you that you're one of those.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the way you participate in the global conversation, basically.
Yeah, you're just in it. You know, it's like a fish asking them to explain water, right? Same kind of thing. All right, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with our panel about, actually, we're getting ready to shift gears here now, start talking about enhancements to the human architecture. And I'm going to open this up now. We're going to ease into this topic, and I'm going to open it up with just kind of talk about some non-controversial enhancements that are available today, things that people don't even think of as enhancements, but that are. You know, when you think about even your automobile, right, is this extension of your own capability, or a bicycle maybe takes it a little closer to home. In fact, I had put a post up on the Speculus the other day about these stilts that have springs in them that people are using to, according to the ads, I don't know, but according to the ads, you can run 20 miles an hour with these things on you. So it's this, just, you know, physical extension of human capability that technology has always sort of represented, is there, and no one questions that or says, well, that's bad. We shouldn't do that. That's a given. And then we have cognitive enhancement available, potentially via nutraceuticals, or, you know, which would be of questionable effectiveness, I think, at best, or things like caffeine, which I certainly can't live without. And you can have, you know, physical enhancement through, I don't know, diet and exercise, maybe through surgery or tattooing or piercing. But that's kind of the state of enhancement as it existed for a long time, leading up to where we are now. And my question is there a tipping point coming where enhancements will be widely practiced and broadly accepted that go well beyond the kinds of things that have existed up to now in terms of extending our physical abilities or extending our cognitive abilities or modifying our appearance? And if there is such a tipping point coming, what do you think it's going to be? And I'll start with Brian on that one.
Okay. First, just to comment on your introduction there, I'm actually I think there's more potential in nutraceuticals and in the non-FDA-regulated food or things that we can ingest, basically because of Genescient, a company that is taking fruit flies that they have been raiding for 25 years on a selective basis, and now live four times longer than normal fruit flies. And so they've identified pathways, and they're trying to track back.
That's Greg Benford's company, correct?
Greg Benford's company, right.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're trying to track back to see, okay, how can we activate this using something that we don't have to spend 10 years getting approved through the FDA? So then they'll look at, you know, roots and herbs and whatever that would have the active ingredient that would help out. So I think that could be pretty good and as powerful as, or you know, various pharmaceuticals. It's like they're finding now that, you know, that life extension thing for the mice, one of the more powerful effects, stronger than the resveratrol kind of effect, was from a immune suppressant fungus thing that they had approved for other purposes that actually has this powerful life extension effect in mice. So I think, you know, just like you're finding drugs that you think for other purposes, that you test them, you can find something else. You can suddenly find something for herbs and other things, they have more effect. So then going back to the other two questions, sorry, just a quick reminder.
Actually, it was an either or. We're looking for where you think, if there is a tipping point, would it be in physical capabilities or cognitive or physical appearance, or where do you think it will occur?
Okay, so I think there's basically a non-tipping point where the stuff that we do use and accept gets a lot better and kind of goes in through the back door and people start using it. And also where people don't have to buy into the whole thing, I'm going to have everything to sale, that's useful, and now I'll start using it. So things like the iPhone, if you look at, I guess we're on 3.0 now or something like that, we'll go up to iPhone 10.0, which is probably like 7 years from now, you know, that thing could be, you know, 1,000 times more powerful and not to worry about batteries because it's also got some power management stuff, and then it's wired in at 100 times the speed. And right now they're integrating all kinds of devices into it to, like, sensors and stuff to, just the accelerometer thing that they put into it was a big deal, but then GPS and more cheap devices that they're bringing into it, I think will radically alter its capabilities. And even being able to, I think there's some work to add in microscopes and stuff for third world countries for someone to do a lab analysis with that. So if more and more devices get hooked up into it to make it more and more useful, then the enhancement of productivity and capability would be vast.
So so I can understand you, Brian, are you making an analogy of the iPhone, or are you actually describing the iPhone as an augmentation and enhancement?
I am describing the iPhone as augmentation and enhancement.
Okay.
currently there's an app you can buy for $1 that can help you solve the Rubik's Cube. You use the camera on the iPhone, you take 6 shots of your scrambled cube, and then it automatically gives you the instructions for solving it. And this is something, of course, 0.2 years ago when the Rubik's Cube came out, everyone wanted to figure out how to solve it, and now spend $1 and you're enhanced to be able to solve any cube. And kind of like instant skill that you would have. And then there's other apps where helping you to do a sniper thing. You have a kind of sniper buddy that helps you take windage and do other stuff to help you make a better shot of that. So making people, you know, more enhanced, more dangerous. But then all sorts of other tracking sensors are integrating in through the iPhone as well. And the iPhone, because you're carrying it always with you, is kind of like always available for you. And then,
so here you have this tremendous extension of our brain, of our nervous system, that basically you can put in your pocket and continuously upgrade. And
yeah.
I think that's tremendous, because certainly if you count that as an enhancement, it has certainly already tipped, right? I mean,
right.
we don't have to wait for the iPhone to hit a
right. And then if you add in the brain to computer interface thing and work those in, because some of those have been coming to computer games and stuff, or there's some stuff where you have ultrasound that can be beamed into your brain that could turn off or turn on various parts of your brain. You could certainly use that for mood control, you know, biofeedback, other things. So there's ways where that could really, you know, get far closer and far, farther along the path to serious enhancement beyond the kind of like mild examples that I was giving. And then the other thing is gene therapy. Gene therapy, stem cells is kind of the other way that it'll go, and probably it's going to have to come through China or some other place where they don't have as many issues around it.
I love that, Brian, because, I mean, I've long thought that Google, I've claimed it as, you know, an extension of my own brain, and now that we can actually carry it with us, that it does, it does seem to amount to an enhancement. Do you see a tipping point in the future, or are we just going to slowly ease into human enhancement?
I'm of two minds. I mean, going back to what I was saying before, the ease with which we tend to integrate stuff that comes up, you know, in terms of the speed of change, people may not notice, particularly young people. And one of the things you find with people who are resistant to change, you know, is when the gene therapies become available, when the medicine or nutraceutical becomes available that makes you feel better and makes you healthier and makes you younger, possibly as a side effect or of curing diseases or improving upon pathological problems, they're going to be online along with everybody else. So these things just are so natural to human beings that in some sense we take them in stride. I do see, I mean, I think replaceable parts or improved parts could be something that might get people to sort of take notice and say, wow, something here has changed. You know, we've had amputee sprinter, I think his name is Oscar...
Pistorius?
Oscar Pistorius, you know, where the Olympics were nervous about letting him compete, you know, the implication being that he might actually have an advantage. And I think, you know, both in terms of, you know, sort of cyborgian technological parts and in terms of improvements or replacement parts that would come about as a result of genetic manipulation and so forth, that could sort of ring a chime for people and make them go, wow, something has really changed. I also think, I mean, there's been some experimentation with retinal implants, and while this isn't specifically an enhancement upon the average human being, I think that if, you know, a year from now we suddenly find that, you know, 30% of the blind people in the world or in the country are, you know, able to get an implant and they're no longer blind, that's something that where people might sit up and take notice. I want to say one other thing, Ramaz Nam, who wrote the book More Than Human, mentioned in his book that somebody...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, are you?
Somebody involved in biotechnology told him that he thought that one of the easiest bio hacks that probably would occur during the coming decade would be changing skin melanin, changing people's skin color, and not just to the usual choices, but to, you know, alternatives like purple, orange, or blue, or whatever. And I think, you know, as accustomed as we are to a body mod in our culture, I think when we can't tell what color people are and when we see them walking around multicolored, you know, that may shake us a little bit and make us think that something a little extraordinary is happening. At least briefly, until we become accustomed to it.
It's amazing how fast we could get used to something like that. Although living in Denver, I can't help but think that we're going to see tons of people walking around with their faces permanently orange and blue in support of the Broncos, which is a horribly sad idea, really, when you think about it.
I kind of appreciate the banality with which some of these things get adopted, you know, with the Botox injections and plastic surgery and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, you look at the pain of the average, you know, the tragedy of the commons, right? That's where a lot of this starts to originate, I think. So, what do you think, PJ, in terms of a tipping point?
I'm not so sure that there is going to be an actual tipping point. I do think there will be moments, as RU says, where people will sit up and take notice. And then it'll go away again. It's a line in the sand that keeps on getting redefined and redefined throughout human history. What is an enhancement versus what is simply part of the culture? And I think, you know, probably for me in my lifetime, one of the big ones where people sat up for a moment and went, this is extraordinary, were reproductive technologies, where, you know, IVF, et cetera, where you could, if you were infertile, be able to have a child. That was a moment in human history where everybody went, whoa, okay, things are not the same anymore. And then we went on from there, you know. and now half my friends delay having children and use IVF to have them. I think that these coming technologies are going to have some very similar things where we will have those really interesting moments, and there will always be the exact same argument. It's almost a boilerplate argument where they fill in the blank that this is against the will of fill in your God. And, you know, this is not what a human being is. And then suddenly it is. And we continue to roll on as a species. That's why I find it hard to actually see anything as far as a true tipping point. Because it's just so gradual and accumulative. Therapy becomes enhancement, which becomes ubiquitous.
It's interesting that you mentioned the example of IVF. I had written about that on the blog, referencing the story in H Plus about designer babies. To think that 30 years ago, this shocking, screaming headline story, test tube baby. I mean, you remember how big that was, what a big deal that was. To today, where if someone has a child and it's a multiple birth, you know, it's just...
You assume.
You know, I mean, are you were talking about the banality of it, right? Somebody will go, oh, IVF, right? You know what I mean? Whatever. I mean, it is a point of mild and passing interest. To maybe account for why there was more than one kid, and that's it, right? That is the extent of the emotional reaction, I think, that people have one way or another over that.
Just a comment from me then. I would say that in terms of a tipping point, you'd have to, one, the improvement would have to be a lot outside the norm of what we, you know, okay, you got 5%, 10% more, you took steroids, you know, you got strong or something like that. It would have to be something where it's like, you know, it's an Incredible Hulk, you know, comic book 100 tons, you know, something where it's like so much beyond what we're currently experiencing that someone would say, oh, holy crap, right? So I could see, you know, like if some of the DARPA stuff plays out, you know, where you have, you know, they get the sled dog endurance into people and it helps them burn off all their fat, and they get a bunch of other things to work out, you know, myostatin improvements or safe steroids and a bunch of other things in combination all at once, say over, you know, a couple-year period, and suddenly you have, you know, super soldiers walking around, then that would be something which would, you know, be the shock the world kind of Sputnik super, you know, thing which would – and it would also be something that would be – kind of like in your face. The other thing, though, is that just strength and just endurance and just those kind of performance things don't really change, I think, productivity that much. Like, you know, the comic book thing, but then there's the actual economic productivity, the actual impact, which would be, you know, more on the intelligence, creativity, making the right choices kind of thing of, you know, being able to make a good government budget kind of thing and be able to put money in the right spots, you know, those would be, as a society, probably a bigger impact than just, you know, guys walking around lifting 10 tons.
I do think that stuff that reminds people of science fiction and superhero comic books has a certain resonance with people that make them stand up and go, okay, you know, it happens, you know, every other day, but people keep saying, oh, my goodness, yes, we are entering into science fiction world, science faction world. As an example, the most popular article on the H Plus magazine website is called "Hybrid Assistant Limb Cybernetic Suit." And if I could just read the first paragraph, actually, is Cybernetic Corporation of Japan, in conjunction with Dollhouse, has begun mass production of a cybernetic bodysuit that augments body movement and increases user strength by up to tenfold. So apparently this sort of thing is already being, on the verge of being mass produced. I haven't gotten my own yet, but
every guy listening, everyone listening is going, I've got to get me one of those, right?
Right.
There's your super soldier right there.
Exactly.
Well, the Japanese are making it more for helping the elderly because they're having such an aging population, and I think the suit, enhances 10 times for elderly, but I don't think it's like it enhances like an Arnold Schwarzenegger or whatever 10 times. It is a good thing. Also, the manufacturer was not selling to the military. He was specifically against selling to the military because he was pacifist or something like that.
Well, it won't stay pacifist for long. If you have a technology like that, and all of a sudden armor becomes possible again. One of the reasons that we don't dress like knights going into battle anymore is because that kind of armor doesn't stop the projectiles that are being sent our way. But if you can lift 10 times or even 3 or 4 times what you could lift normally, then all of a sudden you can armor up a soldier in ways that you never could before.
Well, the Lockheed is field testing the it's Hulk, H-U-L-K, which is a lower extremity thing that the bleak suit that they made in Berkeley, I think it was, that kind of got picked up by Lockheed. So they're field testing that. It doesn't help your arms, but it goes up to your shoulders. So then you can have an attachment, then they have it in a video online, which they have the riot shield. So they can carry the riot shield in front of you with a kind of a little extender thing, so your arms aren't holding it, it's kind of attached to the suit. And I think they also have a gun mount on it, so you can have a little turret kind of spinning around, kind of like a Predator, shooting at stuff. And then help you run. You can run about, I think in bursts, up to 10 miles per hour and at a steady rate for about 2 hours at 7 miles per hour. So,
well, hey, my stilts will get you to 20, man. Come on.
That's right. Well, they're working that in. That's not really stilts. I saw that kind of thing. It looks kind of more like, another knee joint, and then it's...
Yeah, exactly. It's like the spring-loaded additional knee. You get an extra joint in your leg. That's the basic idea. I don't know if you watched that video. Isn't very interesting, but you see some others, people jumping. It looks like they're jumping like 18 feet in the air. It's just amazing some of the stuff people do with those things. You know, Brian, one of the things you mentioned, just to close this one out before we move on to the next question, gene therapy, we didn't spend a lot of time on, but if I were going to take a stab at a tipping point, I think something huge will happen the day Dr. Oz shows up on Oprah and says, this insulin receptor gene, this thing Ray Kurzweil talks about all the time, right? You can turn this thing off and you'll never gain weight anymore. You'll be thin for the rest of your life. If demand for that gets out there, if that treatment suddenly becomes something that people are start asking for, and I think if given the scenario I just gave, that you would have, people marching on the FDA in Washington, right, to make it happen. But it seems to me that kind of banal thing, hey, we don't want to be fat anymore, would bring an awful lot of stuff along with it. What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think that would be a popular enhancement. I think there's several ways you can have doing it, either with a safe muscle enhancement, we could burn more calories. And I think also the gene enhancement, the stem cells, looking at the details of that, it appears that it's where you can localize it. Like, okay, you can have a lens where it introduces stem cells in my eyes and fixes my vision. They already have that in a few lab trials that they've done successfully. Or if you have some other treatment where you're localizing where it is, so you're not like sending the gene changes throughout the whole body and changing something that you're like, oh, I didn't know that was going to change that and mess it up and kill you or cut them with the problem. So I think it's going to be this kind of as much as possible, make the change as short as possible, and also I think they need to clear out, you know, like don't like leave kind of like litter of like virus shells kind of inside your body to, when they've delivered the genes and stuff like that. So I think it needs to be, that's the kind of way it's going to be introduced. So then you can kind of think, okay, well, eyes, ears, liver, you know, something where you can try and get more control, and also maybe work it with stem cells where if we can take, you know, some of your blood out of your body, alter it, and then stick it back in, or, you know, take the bone marrow, alter it, stick it back in, so that you're not shotgunning this change all over the body and, like, just, you know, change what you want to change and then, you know, let the rest kind of go so you're not messing up with that.
Brian, I was just going to say that you're talking about designer adults.
Right, designer
like
adults.
That,
right.
Yeah, I like that even better than designer babies.
Well, interesting you should mention designer babies, Stephen. Good transition there, because that was actually our next question. We saw the article in H+. Michael Anisimov had written on designer babies, a term that is not as popular with some of us transhumanists as even the term transhumanism is. Here's my take on designer babies. Okay. I think that parents are going to do what they perceive to be in the best interest of their children, and that's kind of a paraphrase of where James Hughes came down on that issue, and that it won't be long before PGD, this pre implantation diagnostic, this checking for traits and selecting based on traits is going to be as commonplace as IVF is now, and as controversial as that might be today. It will be as straightforward and banal as IVF is today. So I think trait selection becomes accepted, but in vitro genetic modification, now that's going to kick off a whole new controversy. And I was really interested to read in the article how parents would say, you know, 75% are in favor of doing it to prevent having a mentally retarded child, or 54% to prevent deafness, 56 for blindness, 52 for heart disease, and it starts kind of ticking its way down to where only 10% would be willing to select embryos for better athletic ability, and 12.6% would select for greater intelligence. Now, half said that there were no conditions for which genetic testing should never be offered, which indicates that there's fairly widespread support for this. But the rider on that was, as long as it's for averting disease and not engineering human enhancement. So this sounds like a leap that maybe people aren't quite ready to take emotionally. And I guess to restate Stephen's question, if we're looking at genetic modification, it sounds like we're going to see designer adults long before we see designer babies. What do you think of that assessment?
I think you're right, because people will tend to go towards things where they can see the effect immediately, and you know, germline engineering and that sort of thing is pretty mysterious still, and you know, I think that largely explains some of the trepidation that people have when they think about it and hear about it. You know, even if you're not particularly educated, I think you probably know intuitively that we're not quite there yet, and that it would be very difficult to precisely engineer germlines for specific enhancements, you know, in a way where we can be pretty sure of what the results would be and so forth. But I think, you know, once people get the idea that when this can be done and done well, and people get the idea that it can be done and done well, then people will start doing it, and people will start talking to people who start doing it, who have started doing it, and I think, you know, it will probably slide in there almost as easily as many of the other things that we've been talking about.
I also think there's an issue of informed consent, which is why adult therapy is absolutely going to happen before germline. You have to be able, in this society, to make large changes, any kind of change, legal change or physical change, you have to have consent. And without consent of the child, that's when you start getting into ethical issues, that until we know we can do it right every time and there won't be a problem, and as RU said, other people have done it and they're and have shown to be successful, you're not going to have engineered babies in quite the same manner.
I think it's also just a safety thing that you know, you're making the change, and it kind of relates to what RU was saying in terms of knowing what you're doing in terms of twiddling the genes and stuff like that. It's just you wouldn't know. You think, oh, okay, I'm just gonna change this and this, and it's gonna be fine. It's like you couldn't really be certain about it. So definitely you'd be making that kind of germline engineering on cows or dogs, and making sure that monkeys and stuff, you make sure you got it right. So you may have an uplifted monkey before you actually go on humans, except for the case of maybe someplace like North Korea or, you know, someplace, you know, kind of outside the mainstream country that is going to do whatever they want. And don't care if there's side effects of, oh, we, you know, had to toss 1,000 or 1,000,000 embryos before we got that right.
Very interesting.
Well, I was just going to say, college students are taking Adderall and Ritalin and various other drugs to enhance their cognitive abilities. And the truth is, even though these things are illegal, people do them if they see that they work. So I guess I'll address it to RU. If people
oh, you asked
see
me the question about drugs, huh? I see.
Yeah, that was perfectly random.
Yeah, I'm just throwing it your way, man. If people see that the testing of embryos for intelligence and other things works, whether or not it's legal, I mean, I just suspect that people are going to do it. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there'll be an underground market for this sort of thing, probably even before we know that it works. I mean, if wealthy people who have a tendency towards technophilia get the idea that it might work, you know, I mean, look at the stories about Michael Jackson and cloning, just to put a really dark spin on it. You know, people will go to clinics in China or Singapore or wherever this sort of thing might be being experimented on, and they'll give it a try. Probably, you know, predictably, probably a little bit before the results are predictable. Over the long term, yeah, just like with drugs, you'll have an underground. You'll have all the problems that come with having an underground. And, of course, it'll be very expensive, so the first customers of that underground will be the wealthy.
Okay, yeah. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about human enhancement, and we'll be we're looking for your responses to this for everyone listening live. We've got a lively chat going on in our chat room, so please pass your questions on to Michael Darling, and we'll be responding to those a little bit later in the program. You know what's interesting about that transition from an underground to a mainstream movement with this particular scenario, unlike, say, where we were talking about gene therapy for treatment of obesity or something like that, is if people were to do this in an underground way, germline, I'm talking about engineering of their children, and suddenly you have these kids showing up in school, just a few, who are markedly, you know, stronger, better looking, you know, whatever, smarter than their peers. I mean, just ridiculously improved over their peers, and that's kind of the best case scenario, right? That's if you avoid the safety issues and you and things work the way they're supposed to. I don't see that one just catching on all of a sudden. You know, it seems to me there might be kind of a Village of the Damned sort of effect, that right? Kind of a Fear of the Gattaca thing going on there. That
right, the freaks, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
But let's put this in perspective, people. We have people who are freakishly beautiful. We have people who are freakishly intelligent. we have people who are freakishly strong, outside the norm already. Those people, you know, those are the Liz Taylors, and those are, you know, these are people who already exist. And we just go, wow, that person is gorgeous, or whatever. That person's just brilliant. You know, Stephen Hawking, there are people out there who mark the outer edge of that intelligence. Now, if there are people who could somehow go beyond Stephen Hawking, well beyond, where you sort of go, well, okay, you know, now all of us are somehow of average intelligence compared to this person, that's where people are going to start to take notice. Otherwise, I don't know about you, but there was always some kid in my school who was like, okay, I don't know what planet you came from, but and I don't think their parents were practicing germline therapy.
I think, though, that the genetically modifying the kids and stuff is too slow, because the kid has to grow up. So in the meantime, you know, we would have pharmaceutical ways, like instead of gene therapy, because one of the things that may slow gene therapy up is that you do the gene therapy in mice or with other things, and you figure out, oh, well, if we I just make a drug, a pill, to do the same thing, then you don't have to have the gene therapy. I just give you this, and it blocks the myostatin. I give you this, and it does whatever. And so they can still convert it into something that you can just swallow normally, and they can sell you 30 of it each month kind of thing, where, one, they make more money that way, and two, you know, it's going down the well-trodden path. But then it doesn't take, by doing it to adults and older people, the effect is the same, you know, perhaps, but then they don't have to wait 10 years for the kid to grow up, or maybe 8, I guess, or 5 if they've been modified to grow up faster and mature faster and like that. But it still would seem to take longer to do it that way. In the meantime, technology progresses, and, you know, you can have the enhancement and even better some other way. Like, the guy is now 10 times stronger than a normal person, but then you got the guy wearing the Iron Man suit, who's 100 times stronger. It's like, he can still take it off. He's still, he didn't, you know, modify it that way. So it's like, you know, 5-10 different ways to do the same thing.
Right.
I honestly think we're going to end up with the brain jack a hell of a lot earlier than we're going to end up with the genetic modification or the somatic modification for intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
So go on.
Yeah, I think if you can radically improve all the component parts, you sort of don't have to change the core program. It's you're going to be different as an emergent function of having all those parts having been improved.
And so, are you PJ? When you talk about the brain jack, you're talking about mechanical, electronic enhancement to the brain?
I'm talking about some kind of outward enhancement that is not genetic, be it biochemical, be it a convergence technology, that's, you know, a nanotechnology, whatever. It's. I think we're going to kludge and hack it in that sense long before we actually crack how to reprogram our DNA for it.
Okay, fair enough. And we'll get to the topic of likely modifications that we're all looking for here a little bit later. But before we do, I think I want to spend a little more time on the somatic thing. Stephen, you've got a question I think you want to lay on the group.
Well, I'm thinking about some more horizons that looks like we're close to crossing here in the future, near future. A couple of days ago, we heard this story about how human sperm is now being produced in the lab. Basically, take a human cell and they can modify it to make it a sperm. So it looks like it won't be long before we see women being able to father children. And you know, a year or so ago, we saw a man who was born a woman, but became a man, give birth to a child. So I'm wondering, you know, is it going to be long before we see a man who is born male give birth? And, what do you guys think about that? I guess I'll address this one to Brian.
You know, it'll be an interesting thing if it happens, but it's, you know, of the probably, 70 million bursts a year kind of thing, it'll just be, you know, a handful of people who do it or 100 people. It won't be, I don't see how it would be the preferred path to go about doing it. You know, I guess it'd be relevant for certain lesbian or gay couples who want children or something like that, but which I guess could be a significant percent of the population, but I don't see, you know, how it goes much beyond that.
Well, I wonder what the implications are for the transgendered population, right? Which is kind of where the original story from last year originates, where, you know, man gives birth, that's the big, you know, dog bites man kind of story. But it, you know, the caveat on that story, the fact that actually the man used to be a woman, speaks to kind of the limitations of what we're really able to accomplish in terms of this full bore ontological sex change, right? To actually change a person's sex. You know, is that going to be a big deal for people, or did we already achieve the big deal when we were able to make the superficial change earlier in the reproductive thing?
Well, I think because that whole area is kind of you know, politically charged and religiously charged, and that I guess, you know, it'll make waves politically and stuff like that. Just, you know, for me, the futurist looking at it kind of thing is kind of like 5% of the population that currently is in effect neutered can now have children, and they can go about it in this kind of technological enabled way. It's all right, but it's, you know, I don't really get that. To me, it's not that interesting. But
not
know,
all that worked out.
Right.
DJ, are you? What do you think?
I think it's interesting in the sense. I mean, first of all, the fact that you know, you have the popular use of trans, and you know, as far back as the 1950s, actually in Germany in the 1930s, but you know, we've been able to have a gender change, that's or at least partial gender change, and we've been able to sort of integrate that, and you know, we've forgotten what a shock to the system that was. I think that these issues of gender and sexuality and identity really operate on a very deep sort of subterranean level, and that the people are reactive to it in a way that might not be specific, might not be a bunch of men going, you know, they don't need me anymore, they've got artificial sperm, or this man gave birth to a baby and it weirds me out. You know, that kind of expression, but you know, you see sort of a resistance to gender transition going on in our culture. I think you see an acceptance of it, and you also see a sort of a resurgence of macho and a real desire to hold on to gender identities as we've long understood them. So I think it's really something interesting that operates on a very deep psychological level. I don't know if it's that interesting as a technological change per se, but these issues of identity, I think, are really interesting.
Okay. PJ, thoughts?
I have to agree with RU. I don't find it terribly interesting from a futurist level, but I find it deeply fascinating from an identity level. And just the notion, I think probably the most radical notion that's finally starting to crack into the mainstream just a little bit right now is the notion that there really isn't just, you know, a male and a female, a gay and a straight, you know, in essence, a one and a zero sexuality. Sexuality is not binary, it's on a continuum. And just the idea that people are starting to realize, well, wait a second, so he was a man who now wants to be a woman, but is he gay or is he straight? As that, you know, there are all these issues And is he gay this week or next week? That's fascinating. But again, as a futurist, I find it fascinating just because I think people will become more and more accepting of the fact that sexuality is a fluid continuum as opposed to an either-or situation.
And, of course, this is something that's in full bloom in virtual reality and in Second Life. And,
oh, yeah, exactly. Yes.
And so forth.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's move ahead. Let's take a little trip into the future. Here's what I want to do. Let's visit a high school 3 or 4 decades from now. Okay? Now, in the classroom or in the gym or interacting in the halls, how are those kids different from high school kids today? And I'm not talking social stuff. I'm saying, what do you observe that is different about them than the children of today?
I'm sorry, these children in the future? I'm sorry, these children in the future?
Yeah, 3 or 4 decades from now.
3 or 4 decades. Okay, sorry. I don't think they're going to be in a classroom or in a hallway.
Uh-huh.
Okay, wherever they are.
Where do you come across?
Home plugged into their school-a-tron, wherever we happen to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think school, the better a virtual world becomes, the more socialization can actually happen within it. We're only just now starting to understand the etiquettes that need to be created. The etiquette as complex and highly subtle etiquettes that exist in our world have to exist in the virtual world to navigate that. And we're only just becoming aware of how to communicate. I mean, hell, most people don't even know how to deal with a cell phone. They don't know when to talk on it, when not to talk on it, when that's rude, when it isn't. So I think, you know, as these etiquettes develop and we become all more custom and comfortable dealing within a virtual world, why does anybody have to go to school? We can become socialized at a certain level virtually. I still believe that a lot of stuff is still face-to-face until, I don't know, maybe 3 decades from now we'll have virtual worlds that are as sensitive to the unbelievably subtle facial expressions that we can pick up on with each other. When that time comes, then perhaps we could be socialized both ways.
Okay.
So I know that the DARPA and the Army are working on holographic, virtual room and other kind of enhanced training capabilities. So in 30, 40 years that, you know, they succeed in that, and I think it's possible they could, that and other kind of education transformations where, you know, asymptotically kind of going toward the matrix kind of, you know, upload of knowledge kind of thing would totally change what is considered to be education in school, much like PJ was talking about. But then if you're just saying, okay, in 30, 40 years, how much enhancement do we have? I think, and what would those people be like, you know, teenagers or adults kind of thing? I think that, you know, like the nanotechnology happens and then you'd have massive amounts of, nano devices that can alter and change things along with, you know, DNA and synthetic biology and with other things that the future shock potential of how much of that could actually work out along with massively integrated cybernetic systems and stuff like that, you know, would definitely have the potential, if you haven't lived through the years leading up to that point, to go, okay, I'm going to coma now, I wake up 30, 40 years, and it's like, you know, could very well be massively altered. But I think that counteracting that would be people would want to do it. If there's a way to do it very shocking in your face kind of thing, most people would choose a more mundane kind of like less shocking way to do it, but still get the benefit.
Right. Well, I think that what PJ said about Second Life is telling, and I think, Brian, that for some of it, like my avatar in Second Life looks as much like me as I could make it look. Right. Now, we're talking here about a world in which basically you can manifest in meat space a lot of the same kind of stuff, capability, potentially, that you could in today that you can in Second Life. So I'll put the question to you now, are you? What are those kids going to look like? Dorsal fins, fur, feathers, big spiders walking around? What are we going to see?
I think tails and dorsal fins. I think you might find them running around, I think, or at least a lot of people running around in a situation that's not dissimilar to Burning Man. They might want to find themselves, seriously, they might want to find themselves surrounded by incredible creativity and art and, pleasure and extraordinary experiences that can be had by groups of people who are together. And, you know, in the meantime, they'll have all the information, the human system probably, like, implanted behind their eyes or something like that. They'll have access to nanotechnology. They'll have access to high-tech environments and so forth when they want them, virtual reality and so forth. I think and I hope that we might find that a lot of people have integrated play and work, creativity and production and so forth, and that might be the kind of environment that you see in 30 years if we're lucky.
Well, my fear is that while we can, if we enable things like this, my fear is that the flip side will also happen, and you'll also have the people who desire to destroy, to damage, to wreak malicious havoc. And for instance, you know, the whole idea of neurohacking. How many of these kids, instead of just you know, today, if kids can cyberbully, et cetera, but what if you could neurobully?
Wow.
Could screw with somebody else's head. Yeah, that was
you know, that's the ultimate nightmare.
That's a scary
to me, at least.
That is a scary thought. Well, and to go back to your earlier point, PJ, because when I asked about the kids, you immediately went to the environment. Do you think it's a fair bet to say that the richness of the virtual experiences that would be available by that time would obviate the need for kids in actual real 3D space, meat space, to go with the dorsal fins and the spider appearance, since they would have that in the virtual world where they're spending all their time anyway?
Well, you're assuming that they have one costume, if you will. The option is, especially if you're dealing with virtual versus a reality, you know, I hate using the word reality again, and I don't like meat either. I find that word, I know it's very chic and very geek, but I find the word meat quite derogatory, because I actually like my body, and I like having a body.
Can we call it fish?
But I do, I would not be surprised if 30 or 40 years from now we have the ability to change our physical appearance in much the way we can change our virtual appearance. So, you know, kids especially try on different costumes. They try different tribes. They try, you know, the Burning Man thing, I think, RU is really quite clever and actually a great image, because, you know, at Burning Man you've got these little tribes that form, and you've got these little villages and cities and camps that are these subgroups, and you can join in, and what you find is people adopt the dress and the etiquette of those groups. And I think you're going to have the same thing in the future, except it's going to be just so much more malleable to one minute, you know, be fish boy, and the next minute be, you know, bird boy, if you know what I'm saying.
Right. Well, I make that transition all the time myself, so.
But, you know, now what? All of a sudden you think, well, you know, the fish aren't cool anymore. Now the birds are really cool.
Right.
So I just think that search for identity, that is so much part of the adolescent experience. You know, they try stuff on, like trying on hats, and which is what they need to do to finally figure out what they want to be when they grow up, or be who they want to be when they grow up. I think that will just accelerate, and I think it is, as RU also said, it will be a great font of creativity as people try to express themselves in this new way.
Well, PJ,
also the other thing I was thinking about was that instead of changing, you know, the physicality of what you have in terms of, like, you know, adding a dorsal fin that actually is a dorsal fin would be where you, if you have holograms that are real time that can change, that are have the same brightness levels as they can see outdoors kind of thing, then you could have or you could have like Claytronics or nanofog type things where basically you're changing the look and changing the touch and feel, but not necessarily, you know, still you underneath, right? You're not, say, changing yourself. You're getting the super costume, super illusions, and even, you know, making stuff invisible, all that kind of stuff, but where you can change all that kind of perception that you're providing without actually going to the whole way to change your body, which you could do as well, but becomes you have other options again for how you make that the visual change.
And people are
Brian.
Sorry,
I was just going to say that Bernard Benji described in his one of his last novels, I think it was Rainbow's End. He described a technology where basically it was an enhanced reality, sort of virtual reality or real world, but. As long as people choose to participate in your shared reality, they could see what you are in overlaying on the world, which could be like a different appearance for yourself or whatever. It was not; it didn't amount to a hologram, but it was sort of virtual reality overlaid over over actual reality. I thought that was an interesting take on that.
I think there'll be head-mounted displays very soon, like the wearable super workstations with head-mounted displays, and they already have that where you have goggles or have contact lenses which overlay a kind of electronic reality over things, and they can up the resolution on that so that it's more easy to do, and that could be the more energy efficient, easy way to change things. And then it's, I think, kind of like in WALL-E, they had the people in the kind of like hover chairs, but have, you know, kind of jacked into that kind of, you know, over their faces, so they weren't have that kind of reality. So I suspect people still be walking around, but having that kind of display mode would make the changes of appearance and stuff far easier, but because you'd be similar to today, you know, broadcasting your logo, your icon, whatever, you'd similarly be pushing out your reality versions to other people.
Right now we do that with hair dye and piercings, and et cetera.
And people actually starting to use their bodies as, you know, sort of light shows and stuff like that. We have an article on something called a nano tattoo, where people are able to use a composite of nanotubes and polymers under the flesh and able to have facial and hand display. There are a few articles like that on the H Plus website, so people are already sort of using themselves as displays. Going back, of course, to plain old fashioned body mod.
Well, bearing in mind that I got in trouble for directing a question to one person in particular just a little while ago, I'm going to be real careful to just throw this out to the entire panel, and y'all just jump on it. Jump on it when you're ready, okay?
Step carefully there.
I'm being very careful here. What modification, if any, are you personally most looking forward to taking advantage of, and why?
Well, life extension or simple immune system boost, but also I'm also looking forward to the myostatin inhibitors, the kind of a safe version of steroids. I expect that to happen over the next 5-10 years, and expect it to take that. Not just for the fact that it, you know, be far, you know, the strength boost, but also I think it would also put off any kind of aging debilitation kind of thing and maintain mobility longer.
Absolutely, yeah.
What do you think, RU?
Well, I'm going to stick to the neuro tip here, as I did at the beginning of the show. Any sorts of brain enhancements, anything that can bring back my awful memory, give me access to the marvelous things that seem to be sitting in the back of my brain that won't always come to the front of my brain easily. Allow me to have various kinds of altered states that are enjoyable without any deleterious side effects, and all that sort of thing. So that would be number one on my list, because that's the spot from which I experience everything else that might happen.
Okay, what do you think, PJ? PJ, I'm gonna add a wrinkle to the question for you.
Okay.
Which modification are you most looking forward to taking advantage of? Or you can tell us, which ones, if any, are you apprehensive about?
Well, I tell you, it really is, shows my personality. I can see the sides of many sides of the issue. It's a real split between longevity and the neuro for me. I think I'd have to end up, though, ultimately, if I had only one or the other, I'd go for the neuro, because I'd rather, to me, having an enhanced or at least whole psychological experience through the end of my life, if I take good care of myself, would be most desirous. Having personal experience with watching the process of dementia, I certainly don't want to have it myself. So I think ultimately, regardless of when the end of my life would be, I think I would go for the neuro. In terms of what I'm also most concerned about is the neuro. I believe that everything we think that could go wrong will go wrong, simply because it has already gone wrong and we haven't even been poking around people's brains yet. We will have hackers, crackers, spammers, bad advertising. We will be everything you can imagine, every assault psychological assault you have ever had by 10. And we're going to have to develop social laws, mores, ethics, and etiquette to help us deal with the fact that we're going to have much easier access to everybody's head.
That is a sobering notion, isn't it?
Yeah, I forgot to mention the firewall when I was thinking
about
it.
I think that's the very first thing we need.
How about it, Brian? Are there enhancements, modifications, augmentations that you're apprehensive about?
One little point with that, I actually have had and kind of quote unquote enhancement that was looking forward to already happen. In that in 1980, on high school, I was reading about laser eye surgery, and I actually getting LASIK in 1998 or something like that. So, 18-year wait and got that, and I was looking forward to that for a long time because I had glasses and all that kind of stuff. An enhancement that I'm apprehensive about, just to copy what Aziza said, and, just the neuro is one that definitely could have really bad downsides. I guess there could be enhancements that are used for military purposes that could end up, playing out really badly. If it was kind of a super soldier arms race kind of thing and things get really out of hand there, that could be something that could end up being very bad.
Okay. Are you other thoughts on that, or as long as you got the firewall, you're good?
Well, I would echo what Brian just said. Nobody has raised the question of super soldiers, the whole robotic AI thing attached to the military and so forth. And in terms of a tipping point, in terms of capturing people's attention and so forth, there's a tremendous fascination with robotics and with robotic soldiers and that sort of thing, it certainly is a bit scary.
Okay, well, I've got one that I wonder about, and I'll just throw this out here. This is kind of a philosophical question, and I bring it from reading science fiction, which is where a lot of our thinking on some of these topics tends to come from. I remember in Greg Egan's fiction, he talks about a future in which, getting back to the subject of gender just for a moment, that becomes a strictly optional thing. Not whether you're one or the other, but people decide to become neither, and they have no sex to speak of, and they have no gender. Well, that's really interesting. It's interesting to read about it, and he invents pronouns for referencing these people. But one of the ideas I had was, well, at that point you've really pulled a section of what it means or has meant all along to be human out of the equation. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that's one you can pull that out and what's left is still human. But another story I read was about I believe he was a cop who lost his wife in a terrible accident and chose to have a procedure done such that he never grieved, right? Such that he never actually felt that particular loss. And at that point you start to think, well, how much can we pull out of what we've always thought of as being human, and what's left is still a human? Is that something for us to worry about, or am I getting all upset over nothing? Anybody who wants to answer?
Well, I think that the vast majority of people, growing up in what we have now, pretty hardwired, both biologically and culturally, not to go to those kind of extremes, right? Definitely there are percentage, 5, 10, whatever, who might want to experiment or do something that way. I don't see most people going down that road.
No, so I don't either. But let me give you the sorry to interrupt, Brian, but let me take that to its conclusion. It seems to me that, because one of the ideas I've talked about was, boy, if you could remove the inhibition around, like, fear of rejection, you'd have, like, the ultimate salesman, right? We talk about super soldiers. What about the super salesman, right? The guy who just has no fear of rejection whatsoever. Well, what if someone decides it's extremely advantageous to just simply have no empathy for their fellow human beings? Yeah, you wouldn't need millions of those. Just one of those could do an awful lot of damage.
Oh, but we have plenty of them. They're about 3 or 4% of the human population.
Hmm.
Seriously, I'm not joking. Sociopathy is surprisingly common because it's surprisingly successful as a survival mechanism. Most of your very successful people in this world are to some degree sociopathic. If they have no qualms about what it takes to get where they're going, who they have to roll over to get there, and what will happen to those people when they get there, well, I can think of any number of CEOs and politicians off the top of my head who that description would fit. And it's extremely successful as a survival strategy. People, and surprisingly, women choose to breed with them.
That does raise the point that some very powerful forces, you mentioned, politicians and so forth, corporate entities, so might have an interest in breeding or creating these kinds of sociopaths. I think on the whole, as long as lots of people are choosing different types of enhancements, even weird enhancements, it probably just makes things richer and more interesting, it sort of balances itself out. People will be able to handle other people's alterations and so forth from the point of view or from the power of their own. I think if too many people start heading in the same direction, then perhaps that could become problematic.
I do agree with Phil. I think Phil was making the point about if there's some kind of advantage for it, then, philologically, culturally, whatever, economic competitiveness, I think a lot of the driving force behind a lot of these things will be economic productivity. I think that, capitalism and productivity will continue to hold something like that. And so there will be a kind of, you know, one-upmanship, you know, taking the smart pill, taking the whatever, in order, taking the work longer, less sleep mode, whatever, that kind of competition in order to get ahead. You know, the constantly rising bar of what it will take to compete.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, I think that just about does it. Stephen, anything else for our panel before we wrap?
Well, that last bit about sociopaths, it's got me a little worried, because if it's true that we tend to do what we need to do to compete, and if PJ is right about, you know, that being a sociopath is surprisingly useful in competition, then are we going to end up seeing more of those? You know, it's a little worrisome there.
Okay, well, we'll have to end it on a happier note than that. So,
the happy note is that none of us are sociopaths.
Well, that is that makes me feel quite a bit better.
At least that I know of.
I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
I'm a romantic sort of sociopath. You know, I'm a man who plays by my own rules. You know?
There you go. Yeah, that makes it sound so much better. Well,
Just kidding.
Yeah, I think R.U. said it very well, that there, you know, even if we do face some risks here, it seems that the richness of what becomes available to us makes it worth the possibility that there are, you know, some seamy undersides to the whole thing. And I think going back to Brian's original point before I cut him off was that most people aren't going to be inclined to go that way. People don't generally want to be evil. They want to be interesting and have interesting lives. I think we'll see a lot more self-selected dorsal fins than we will sociopaths.
I think we may have Batman and the Joker battling it out more likely in virtual worlds than in real physical worlds. But
wait, did you know, RU, they already have a Green Lantern Corps operating in Second Life?
Oh, good.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Okay, well, I just want to thank our panelists. The time has flown by, as it so often does. Are You Serious? PJ Manny, Brian Wong, thank you all so much for being with us, and we look forward to speaking with you all again very soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
The song is Genevieve, and the band is The Tones.
Okay, The Tones singing Genevieve. Well, thank you for putting that together, Stephen, and for your contribution. Chatters, thanks so much for all you were chatting about out there. Sorry we didn't have time to get to your questions. We had so much to do this evening, but thanks for being part of the program. You can leave your comments at blog.speculus.com. Everyone listening via MP3 and everyone who's part of Fast Forward Radio, thanks so much for being with us, and we look forward to being with you again the next time. Until then, live to see it.